From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, state-of-the-art execution. We talk with Stephen Trombley about the lethal injection machine, the new improved electric chair, and the man who designed them. Trombley's new book, The Execution Protocol, examines America's capital punishment industry. Also today, a concert and interview with jazz pianist and singer Shirley Horn. P.D. James has a new book, and it's not a mystery. Maureen Carrigan has a review. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The FBI has reportedly sent a special hostage rescue team to Waco, Texas, where members of a religious sect are maintaining a standoff with police and federal agents. Four federal agents and two members of the sect were killed yesterday in gun battles that began when the agents tried to serve warrants for federal firearms violations. Agents have been negotiating with David Koresh, the 33-year-old leader of the sect known as the Branch Davidians. Koresh is said to believe that he's Jesus Christ. At least eight children were released from the group's compound today after radio stations broadcast a religious message that Koresh requested. The bombing of New York's World Trade Center last Friday has increased concerns about terrorism farther south in the nation's capital. NPR's Andy Bowers reports.
Although security around the White House and the U.S. Capitol is always tight, the number of police cars and barricades has noticeably increased in the days since the New York bombing. Washington and Capitol Police confirm that security has been stepped up while declining to give details. Many at the Capitol clearly recall the bomb that exploded near the U.S. Senate chamber in 1983. But Friday's incident has also sparked political as well as police action. New fears about terrorism encroaching on American shores today moved Senate Majority Leader George Mitchell to say that prudence and caution dictate a reassessment of standing anti-terrorism laws and practices. While stressing that he will wait to find out who's responsible for the World Trade Center bombing, Mitchell says he's told Senate Judiciary Chairman Joseph Biden to lead a review of counterterrorism efforts. I'm Andy Bowers in Washington.
U.S. Air Force officials say yesterday's airdrop in Bosnia was a success, but reports on the ground indicate that packages of food and medicine may have fallen into the hands of Serbian forces. Lynn Weil reports.
Croatian radio is saying that the aid delivery did not reach the Muslims who have been cut off from supplies for nearly 11 months. The report was corroborated by the Serbian commander in Sarajevo, who implied that the food and medicine landed in areas controlled by Serbs. Earlier today, authorities at the base in Germany where the operation is centered were saying that the packages landed where they were supposed to go. But now the report has changed. Major Dave Cannon is a spokesman for the airbase.
We have no verification. Again, nobody on the ground to verify it. But I would like to point out that the aid is intended not for one group over another group.
Cannon says if the aid fell to the Serbs, it could have been because their forces have gained ground, or the wind could have pushed the parachuted bundles off course. For National Public Radio, this is Lynn Weil reporting.
Stock prices closed lower today in mixed trading on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost more than 15 points to close at 3355.4. Advances led declines by a slight margin in heavy trading. This is NPR. Health Secretary Donna Shalala expressed skepticism today with the reasons for high drug and vaccine prices given by the nation's pharmaceutical industry. Shalala and her top lawyers met with leading vaccine makers. After the meeting, the secretary said she didn't agree with the argument by drug company officials that most of the recent increase in the cost of vaccinations was caused by new drugs and excise taxes. The meeting came as the Pharmaceutical Manufacturers Association took out full-page ads in tomorrow's editions of 40 major newspapers. In Washington state, jury selection got underway today in the trial of a man accused of putting cyanide into Sudafed capsules. The poisonings killed two people and forced a nationwide recall of the drug. Bill Radke of member station KUOW reports from Seattle.
Joseph Mealing of Tumwater, Washington, is accused of putting a cyanide capsule into a Sudafed package in February 1991 in a scheme to kill his wife for $700,000 in life insurance benefits. Then, prosecutors allege, Mealing tried to make the incident look like a random act by poisoning Sudafed in several stores in western Washington. Mealing's wife recovered, but two people died from the poisonings. Their families have settled negligence lawsuits against Sudafed's manufacturer for undisclosed amounts of money. The poisonings prompted a nationwide recall of Sudafed 12-hour capsules. The manufacturer, Burroughs Wellcome, has since repackaged the drug in solid caplets considered less vulnerable to tampering. For National Public Radio, I'm Bill Radke in Seattle.
The sales of existing homes fell in January, but analysts largely dismissed the drop as a one-time aberration. The National Association of Realtors said that sales of previously owned homes fell by 6.4% in January. That was the first drop since late last summer. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Capital punishment is legal in 36 states, and when the state takes someone's life, the idea is to do it as humanely and efficiently as possible. We have high-tech options like the electric chair and the more recent invention, the lethal injection machine. Hanging is still legal in two states. The capital punishment industry and the technology of execution are the subjects of my guest Stephen Trombley's investigation. He's the author of the book and director of the documentary film, The Execution Protocol. During his research for the book and film, he was given access to the execution team and condemned inmates at Missouri's Potosi Correctional Center. He also conducted extensive interviews with Fred Lucher, the inventor of the lethal injection machine and the creator of a new electric chair. You may find the subject gruesome or morbid, but Trombley says we have a responsibility to think about the way we execute people.
I think if we as a society decide that the correct punishment for people who have killed is to take their life, we should be aware of what is done. It's done with our votes, it's done with our money, and I was really not concerned with asking the question, is this right or wrong, since it already exists. I was out there to describe what happens. And I think whether it's money spent on the space program or health reform, people want to know and should need to know what happens with their taxpayers' money.
Executions were illegal in the United States between 1972 and 76. When they started up again, was there a review of execution techniques and new technology that was investigated?
There wasn't any formal review. And we have to remember that when it started up again, this is a state's issue. It's a state's rights kind of issue. Each state has its own capital punishment law under the Constitution, and they're all slightly different, both in terms of the method of execution and also in the criteria for deciding who is going to be executed, you know, exactly what kind of murder becomes a capital offense. And it's more a de facto thing. You know, as executions started up again, and as they started going wrong, the states began to worry. You know, if you look in 1989 at the execution of Jesse Tefero in Florida, where through an improper connection and an improper head electrode, you know, the man was set alight, you know, and had flames 6 inches jumping out of his head and from his legs and smoke billowing around him, and it took him something like 15 minutes to die, you know something's going wrong. And it's kind of an embarrassment for the state when this happens. So as executions began to go wrong, people began to think about trying to improve them. And that is where Fred Lucher comes in, designing new technology or improving old technology. But what Fred Lucher did, which probably is the most significant contribution, if you will, to executions, is to codify this concept of the execution protocol, a set of rules and a procedure of what to do. Executions, as you know, anyone with an imagination can figure out, are strange and oddly emotional events, not least for the person who's being executed, but also for the people whose job it is to do it in our name. And you know, the history of executions is fraught with confused behavior, malfunctions, and panic. So Fred Lucher, when he invented the lethal injection machine, which was first used in Missouri, wrote a document which became known as the Missouri Protocol, which gave a set of rules for how to carry out an execution. And it's not just the moment of execution or even that day. The protocol really starts to kick in about 10 days before the execution, you know, taking the inmate out of general population, putting him in a special holding cell, an elaborate set of rehearsals, and checking and rechecking, assignment of posts on the night in the prison so that, you know, while you have 8 or 9 people actively involved in the execution, you know, there's another 100 or so within the prison who have security and other responsibilities, and also outside law enforcement agencies who are protecting the prison against any possibility of an attack.
Well, you went to see a state-of-the-art lethal injection machine, which is designed to kill quickly and efficiently. Describe what the machine looks like and the process.
It's an odd-looking thing in two parts. In all prisons in America with lethal injection, you have a death chamber, which is usually a small room, maybe 12 by 14 feet maximum. And if you're looking at the machine devised by Fred Lucher, what they call the delivery module, which contains the syringes, is mounted on the wall. And it's a square box, kind of like something out of an electronics catalog or practical electronics, you know, a very anonymous box. Inside that are 6 syringes, one for each of the 3 lethal drugs that are used. And there are 6 because there's a backup set in case there's any kind of system failure. This delivery module is connected through the wall by a cabling system to a control box, which is another odd-looking square box with 2 buttons on it, which are depressed by 2 executioners. And the machine has a computer inside which chooses which button actually began the execution, the idea being that neither of the people pressing it know who's responsible. It's unremarkable to look at, in a way. It's also very simple. I mean, you simply have a machine which electrically depresses a switch, which releases a heavy weighted piston, which depresses a large syringe, and the chemicals are fed into a single intravenous line connected to the delivery module, which is connected to the inmate.
What are considered to be the advantages of lethal injection as a form of execution?
Well, in a way, I think the arguments, the reasons why states adopt lethal injection is that if you have to carry an execution out as a state employee, it's a difficult business for 2 reasons. Or maybe even 3. The first reason is the inmate doesn't particularly want to be executed. The second reason is you yourself may feel odd about doing it. And thirdly, executions affect the body of the person who's being executed. Now, when you have a gas chamber execution, once the person is choked to death, people have to enter that gas chamber wearing spacesuits, pretty much. The body in the whole chamber has to be sprayed down with ammonia or with chlorine bleach to neutralize the gas. The inmate then has to be undressed, the clothes burnt, and the body sealed in a bag. It's a very unpleasant job. In electrocutions, very regularly, the flesh actually comes away from the bones when the executed person is removed from the chair.
Because the flesh is almost cooked.
It's cooked, as Fred Lucher says, like the flesh off an overcooked chicken. You know, every time there is an electrocution, even if it goes well, you have third-degree burns on the head, which measure about 6 by 8 inches in diameter, which are so severe that they actually expose the skull, and the same with the legs where the electrodes fit. So it's a very, very unpleasant job for people to dispose of the body. And I suppose the advantage of lethal injection is that there is no obvious trauma to the body. And in fact, one of the things that journalists who witness these executions say is that there's almost nothing to report. You know, you don't have a man choking to death. You don't have him jiggling around, set on fire. He's not dangling from the end of a rope or, you know, head cocked to one side after being shot. They simply close their eyes, take a breath. You wait 4 minutes. The curtain goes down, and you've witnessed an execution. And I think that one of the reasons why lethal injection is also a choice for states is the way it affects the public. I mean, something like 70 to 80% of Americans are in favor of capital punishment, depending on which survey you look at. And while they're in favor of it, they don't really want to be reminded every morning over breakfast in a newspaper report about how some guy choked to death for 10 minutes and turned black in the face. And so lethal injection makes it easy on the public. It's easier for us to be in favor of it because it's kind of out of sight, out of mind.
Did you witness any executions while you were researching this book?
No, I didn't. In the year or more, just over a year, that I spent going back and forth to Potosi, two inmates had death warrants and came up to the day of execution and then won a stay on appeal. So I'm happy to say that I didn't watch either of those men executed, Walter Blair or Lloyd Schlupe. After I'd finished the work, and indeed after the film had been broadcast, there was an execution in October, a man called Ricky Boggs, a young man with an IQ of sort of 55 or 58. And they also had another execution earlier this year in January, a man called Marzeh Boulder, who I met briefly when there. But no, I didn't.
Would you have stayed and watched if there was one?
Yes.
Why?
I struggled with myself for weeks before setting off on this journey, wondering whether it was necessary to view an execution, to witness one if it occurred. And I didn't really have the answer to that question when I arrived in Missouri. After I'd been there for a couple of months and got to know many of the inmates fairly well, it seemed to me that I should do, that if one of the people who I would have known were to be executed in the time I was working there, it would almost be part of my responsibility to follow through with the work. And I have to say, I'm very glad that I didn't. And I don't think I have a desire, I know I don't have a desire to see one for the sake of it. I think the only circumstances under which I would witness an execution there would be if one of the men who's become a close friend, A.J. Bannister, if he failed in his appeals and were executed and he invited me, then I would attend with his mother. But simply to view one for its own sake is not something I have an interest in.
My guest is Stephen Trombley, author of the new book, The Execution Protocol, Inside America's Capital Punishment Industry. We'll be back after the short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Stephen Trombley, author of The Execution Protocol. He grew up in the States, but recently has been living in London. But do many states still use the gas chamber?
California has the gas chamber, but have recently passed legislation giving the inmate the option of choosing lethal injection. Colorado still has the gas chamber, although they haven't used it since 1976. And I think that's it. It really, the gas chamber has proved so dangerous and so expensive that, and also I think it's when it's seen as a barbaric way of executing in the way that lethal injection is seen as humane.
Do you think that one of the reasons why lethal injection is seen as humane is that it works through an IV drip or through a syringe, which is technology that's similar to medical technology?
Yes, I do. I mean, I think it's a misappropriation of healing imagery, if you like. You know, it's a piece of magic. You take what looks like benign equipment, medical equipment, normally used in life-saving, and you turn it to a deadly purpose. And I think the idea behind it is that it makes people feel more comfortable with it. Me personally, it seems creepy. It seems bizarre that you would subvert the use of that equipment and actually employ medical and nursing staff to take a life.
Fred Lutcher said to you that we have to worry about the humanity of the people who have to deal with the execution. How are the people who have to actually carry out the execution taught to not only do that in as humane a way as possible, but to do it in such a way so that they can maintain their own humanity?
I don't think there's any way to teach someone this. And I don't think there's many people who work in the penal system who carry out executions who aren't affected by them. I think that the at the end of the day, the most enduring feeling I have from the year I spent on death row was that the people who carry out executions are pretty much regular folks. You know, these are men who have a job working for a state institution, and their job is pretty much to detain people convicted of crimes. And occasionally they are called upon, in our name, to take a life. And every time they do it, I don't think they get more used to it. And I would say that in my experience, most of them aren't perverse in some way. They're not sadists. They're not people who look forward to killing another person. But the development of this concept of the execution protocol, which keeps you so busy in this militaristic style schedule of work, and which breaks the responsibility down across, you know, anywhere between 6 and 12 people, each responsible for some part of the execution, whether it's turning the key to arm the machine, or strapping the person down, or pressing the button, or relaying a radio command, makes you feel that you yourself weren't solely responsible for doing it, but that you as a group of people collectively did it. And it builds a kind of camaraderie among this group of people who do, within the prison system in that state, stand out from the others. It's almost like a special club. And I'd think that none of them are unaffected by it. And while it is part of their job and they will tell you they don't have a problem with it, I think, you know, there are sleepless nights.
I think it was Fred Lutcher who told you that actually the quickest and most painless way of execution is a point-blank bullet to the head. Mm-hmm. That has never been practiced as an official form of execution in the United States, has it?
No. It is the official form of execution in China and in Vietnam and in some states in the old Soviet Republic. In the United States, the firing squad is traditional. It's a traditional military form of execution. But it's one that is fraught with difficulty. Gary Gilmore was the last man executed by firing squad in 1977. But in the 60s, before that, another inmate in Utah, a man called Emilio Mares, was executed by firing squad. And he was someone who was very popular with the prison staff, guards, and so forth. And when it came time for his execution, all 5 of the marksmen aimed away from his heart, none of them wanting to be the person to kill him, with the consequence that they shot him in the shoulder on the opposite side of his body, and it took him nearly an hour to bleed to death with a crushed shoulder. So it's not a foolproof way of doing it.
Does that have anything to do with why the firing squad is not used?
I think the firing, probably not, no.
Right.
The firing squad, again, like hanging, is seen as a kind of ancient technology. You know, the thing with execution technology in the United States is that there is a new development every generation and a half, you know, moving from hanging to electrocution, which came in very shortly after, you know, the introduction of the electric light bulb, and then shortly after World War I. Where there was the experience of gas in the trenches. An army doctor invents the gas chamber. And then finally, and oddly enough, it's a medical man again, we have someone inventing the lethal injection machine. And every successive generation is trying to find this neater, this more technologically advanced way of taking a life, when, you know, in reality, if you want to do the cheapest and quickest thing, yes, you shoot the man in the back of the head with a small caliber pistol.
How did writing this book affect your views on capital punishment?
When I started, I don't think I'd ever been in favor of capital punishment, but it hadn't been an issue that really exercised my brain. Coming away from it now with, you know, 18 months distance, I'm very against it. And for a number of practical reasons as well as any ethical ones, in a state like Missouri where I was, and this is true of many other states, you have three sentences for capital murder: life without parole, which really means throwing the key away and society is protected, life in 50, which means you spend 50 years inside before you're eligible for parole, so you're going to be 66 years old before you even think about coming out, or the death sentence. And why do you need all three? You know, all of them equally serve the purpose of protecting society. Now, the next argument people have is cost. People say, I don't want that man in prison for 50 years at my expense. And one of the odd facts I discovered was that it's about three times more expensive to execute someone than it is to keep them in prison for life. It costs, on average, $1 million to keep a man in prison for 50 years, and on average, $3 million to execute them.
Why does it cost so much to execute somebody?
Simply because of the legal costs associated. And by that, we don't just mean the legal costs of public money being spent on the defense, the appeal of the inmate. The state uses private law firms, too, to help prosecute its case. And, you know, when we talk about the execution industry or the execution business, I mean, that is the part of it that makes most money, lawyers.
Now, you live in England. What kind of execution is practiced there?
Well, England hasn't had capital punishment since 1963. Prior to that, it's always been hanging, at least in the modern period, the last 400 years. And really, there seems little chance that executions would return to this country, despite you know, an overwhelming public support of that. The fact of the matter is, as violent crime begins to rise here and British society becomes more like American, there is an increasing cry for the ultimate penalty. But I think there's a fundamental difference here, which is that Parliament, as a legislative body, it's a different kind of democracy than America. There are certain subjects which Parliament will not allow to come to a plebiscite, because even though you have a Conservative government, essentially, Parliament is a more liberal body than the American houses ever have been and probably ever will be. And it's just simply considered something that isn't right in a modern society.
Stephen Trombley, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Stephen Trombley is author of the book The Execution Protocol: Inside America's Capital Punishment Industry. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Shirley Horn was one of Miles Davis's favorite singers. She's become a favorite of many jazz fans. Coming up, a concert and conversation with singer and pianist Shirley Horn. And Maureen Carrigan reviews The Children of Men, an apocalyptic thriller set in the year 2021, written by P.D. James. This new novel is a departure from the mystery novels that made her famous. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In the wake of Friday's bomb explosion at the World Trade Center in New York City, security has been tightened at U.S. installations overseas and also at the State Department. NPR's Ted Clark reports.
On Friday evening, the State Department informed American embassies and consulates about the bombing at the World Trade Center. The department instructed the missions to review their security situations and take additional precautions if necessary. The department itself was placed on a heightened state of alert Friday evening, spokesman Richard Boucher said, and that alert remains in effect. He said people entering the State Department are now subject to more stringent inspections. Additional security procedures are almost automatically ordered after major incidents like the one in New York, another official said today. He added that the State Department has not issued additional cautions or messages to Americans traveling abroad. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
In New York City, police and the FBI are now investigating parking garage records in their investigation of the bomb explosion. New York FBI Director James Fox said that a videotape of cars going into one of the underground garage entrances also came to light. Fox also said that a car bomb was the likely cause of the explosion, and a heavy one at that, possibly one that would test the springs of any car or any van. At least five people were killed and over 1,000 others were injured in the Friday bomb explosion. There are reports that two more children have been released from a religious compound near Waco, Texas. This would bring the number of children freed from the armed cult fortress to eight. NPR's John Burnett reports.
Reporters on the scene observed two more children driven away by lawmen late this afternoon under gray, drizzly skies at the Mount Carmel religious encampment. It was the first activity around the 77-acre site all day long. In the past 24 hours, Bradley fighting vehicles and armored personnel carriers have been brought in to augment the huge force surrounding the heavily fortified complex. Four federal agents and two members of the religious group have already been killed in firefights yesterday. At least 15 other officers and two cultists were injured. The U.S. Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms refuses to discuss the negotiations except to say that the group is armed with powerful automatic weapons and that it seeks a peaceful resolution of the tense stalemate. In Waco, I'm John Burnett reporting.
In Washington, the government announced today that the number of people on food stamps increased to a new high in the month of December. Officials at the Agriculture Department say more than 26.5 million people collected food stamps in December as economic conditions and cold weather affected more people. More than one American in 10 now gets food stamps. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down more than 15 points to close at 3355.41 on volume of more than 233 million shares. Trading was heavy. This is NPR News. President Clinton has outlined a plan to be phased in over 4 years that would allow students to pay for college by national service work. Speaking this morning at Rutgers, Mr. Clinton called national service nothing less than the American way to change America. Under the plan, $9.5 billion would be spent over 5 years on a national service plan. In the pilot project, some 1,000 jobs would be created with $15 billion from the president's economic stimulus package. On approval of that measure, students would be able to pay back their college loans with a small part of their income. He added it will take longer to phase in the community service part of the idea. Mr. Clinton said that the federal government will allow local communities to choose what community service projects get federal money. In Detroit, Dr. Jack Kevorkian's attorney says his client will not assist in any more suicides until the courts have ruled on a lawsuit filed today. challenging Michigan's ban on assisted suicide. Phil Denary of member station WDET reports.
Kevorkian's attorney, Jeffrey Feiger, made his announcement after the American Civil Liberties Union filed a lawsuit on behalf of several doctors and two cancer patients challenging Michigan's new law banning assisted suicide. What is ironic is that the ACLU has been trying to distance its lawsuit from Kevorkian. Elizabeth Gleischer is an ACLU attorney.
This lawsuit is not brought on behalf of Jack Kevorkian. It has nothing to do with Jack Kevorkian. This law is brought on behalf of physicians and patients, physicians who have ongoing relationships with patients.
The ACLU says the state's ban on assisted suicide is an unconstitutional infringement on personal freedoms. For National Public Radio, this is Phil Denieri in Detroit.
In trading today in Europe, the U.S. dollar was mixed against other major foreign currencies. Gold prices today were also mixed. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Shirley Horn, is the opposite of a belter. She has a small voice and an intimate style. There are performances in which every note and every pause seem perfect. We invited her to record a concert and conversation when she was in Philadelphia last June to perform at the Mellon PSFS Jazz Festival. Horn made her first record back in 1962. One of her first champions was Miles Davis. But in the late 60s, the 70s, and early 80s, Shirley Horn rarely performed outside Washington, D.C., where she's always lived. She stayed close to home to bring up her daughter. In 1988, she started recording for Verve Records, and that led to a comeback that has brought her international acclaim. Her latest album is Shirley Horn with Strings. Performing with her are the longtime members of her trio, bassist Charles Abels and drummer Steve Williams. Shirley Horn is, of course, at the piano. Here we go.
Let's take it nice and easy. It's gonna be so easy for us to fall in love. Hey, baby, what's your hurry? Relax and please don't worry. We're gonna fall in love. We're on the road to romance, that's safe to say. But let's make all the stops along the way. The problem now, of course, is to simply hold your horses, to rush would be a crime, 'cause nice and easy does it. Nice and easy does it. Nice and easy does it every time. Let's take it nice and easy. It's gonna be so easy. Us to fall in love. Hey, baby, what's your hurry? Relax and please don't worry. We're gonna fall in love. Safe to say. but let's make all the stops along the way. The problem now, of course, is to simply hold your horses, to rush. Nice and easy does it. Nice and easy does it. Nice and easy does it.
Or what? That sounds great.
Thank you.
Oh, thank you for being here. Shirley Horn singing, and at the piano, Charles Abels on bass, Steve Williams drums. Shirley Horn, I'm listening to you singing and playing piano and thinking, she almost became a classical pianist. Because you were a prodigy. You had a scholarship to Juilliard when you were young, which I think you never actually took.
No, my parents couldn't afford to. They couldn't afford it.
The scholarship didn't pay your living expenses,
no,
so you didn't
afford
it. Yeah. Now, is that why you didn't become a classical pianist?
I don't know. I really don't know. I didn't know if I would have gone into jazz anyway. But then Earl Garner came along and he influenced me.
Did he come along in person or on record?
No, on record. He had a hit record. It was called Penthouse Serenade. And I remembered that. I used to sit with the record player next to me on the piano, and it plays record over and over and over, and just copy him note for note. He used to drive my mother crazy, but he was like the beginning, you know.
Do you still play classical music? Do you keep up with it?
No, I'm ashamed. No, no. About 10 years ago, I threatened, you know, said, I wanted to do a classical album. But it's laziness. That's pure and simple. It's just lazy.
Well, you've got your hands full, I mean.
Right now, yeah.
Yeah. Shirley Horn, one of your first real champions was Miles Davis. And he, one of the last records that he made before he died was sitting in on one of your recent albums. He got in touch with you after your first record and asked you to sit in with him or to open for him at the Village Vanguard in New York.
No, he asked. I was in Virginia with my husband at my mother-in-law's table, eating all kind of good food and everything. And the phone rang, and I said, Miss Ollie, this is for you. I went to the phone and, Shirley, when I want you to come to New York, some people I think you should meet. And I said to myself, I said, who is this? It's Miles Davis. And I thought it was a friend of mine, somebody making, you know, making a joke with me. And so I went back to the table because, you know, it's all kind of fried chicken and red-eyed gravy and buttermilk biscuits and, oh, boy. And I started thinking. I said, Shep, it's my husband. I said, I think I better go to New York. And I did. I called a friend of the family, met me, and we went to his house to let me know that he was serious. He had some young kids then, and they were singing. I mean, four, five, six like that. They were singing songs for my first record. So, yes, and I did meet some very important people with him.
Did he tell you what he responded to about your music?
He liked my use of space. And my chords, and the way my voicings, and the way I played and sang, you know. Well, the use of space, you know.
It's an interesting thing for him to respond to, since he also used space.
Yes,
in his playing, yeah. So, did you remain close over the years?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We didn't see a lot of each other because he was very busy, you know, but toward the end we, in fact, just last year we were doing the same concert here at the Academy of Music. And we had time here, we had time in France.
Yeah, where you shared the bill with him last year.
Yeah. Yeah, we were very close, spiritually. He was a great man. I miss him a lot. He's part of me is gone with him, you know.
Yeah. My guest is Shirley Horn. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Shirley Horn is joining us at the piano.
I got to get back to your childhood when you were playing classical music.
Mm-hmm.
What introduced you to classical music?
My grandmother told my mother to give me piano lessons because I couldn't stay away from that piano. You go to my grandmother's house, she had a parlor. You know, that's where company went, and it was always cold in there. And she had an old upright piano. And I wouldn't go out and play with the other kids. I would just go and sit on it. And I remember putting on a coat always, and she had a stool, you know, wound up and down. And my grandmother said, told my mother, give me lessons. And so I had lessons when I was 4. I couldn't read or write. Other kids would cry and what have you when they went to take the lessons, and I always look forward to it.
You mentioned it was cold in the parlor where your grandmother had the piano.
That's where company went, you know. But always it was closed. Those French doors were always closed. But I would go in there and they wouldn't bother me, and I'd stay in there always with a coat on. Right? And I'd pick at this piano, you know.
If you don't mind my mentioning this, in between songs you've been putting on gloves.
Yeah, my hands stay a little cold. I have a bit of a problem. Sometimes I play in gloves. In fact, I'll be playing in gloves at night.
Really?
Yeah.
Will you wear those, like, white sheer gloves to play in?
Yeah, these. Same ones.
Yeah,
you know.
Right. So it keeps the circulation better in your fingers?
Yeah.
Is your touch okay? When you're wearing the gloves? So flexible you could pick up a dime, right? You remember those commercials?
Really. Yeah.
those are for rubber gloves, yeah. Well, we have time for one more song.
Okay. It had to be you. It had to be you. I wandered around and finally found the somebody who make me be true. Could make me feel blue. And even be glad. Just to be sad, thinking of you. Some others I've seen, might never be me, but
never be cross or try to be boss. What they didn't do, for nobody else gave me a thrill. With all your faults, I love you still. It had to be you. Wonderful you. It had to be you.
Shirley Horn recorded at the piano in the Fresh Air Studio in the summer of 1992. Her latest album is Shirley Horn with Strings. This is Fresh Air. I have a rundown of some of the stories coming up on All Things Considered. John Burnett reports on the latest from Waco, Texas, following the confrontation between the FBI and the Davidians. Jim Zeroli reports from the World Trade Center, where about one-third of the offices are open after Friday's bombing. And Daniel Shore considers whether all the press speculation about terrorism might actually encourage terrorists. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. How would the world change if we all knew that humankind would be extinct in approximately 60 years? That's the philosophical question contemplated by P.D. James's latest suspense novel, The Children of Men. Unlike her previous 12 books, The Children of Men is not a mystery. Critic Maureen Corrigan says it's fine for James to occasionally investigate other genres, but if it becomes a habit, it could turn deadly.
The year is 2021, and life in England hasn't been this bleak since the Blitz. The Prime Minister and the royals have been ousted. In their place is a twisted tyrant called the Warden. The English, always a little eccentric, have gone completely bonkers. And who can blame them? No children have been born in England or anywhere else on the earth for 25 years. That's ever since every man's sperm, even the frozen stuff, mysteriously became infertile. So now, these final generations of humans are christening kittens instead of babies. The more desperate are reviving grisly pagan fertility rites. And the great libraries and museums of England are being sealed in preparation for aliens who might one day land on Earth and wonder what kind of higher creatures once lived here. P.D. James's new novel, Children of Men, reminds me of other end-of-the-world pop eulogies like On the Beach, Planet of the Apes, and that old pretentious rock and roll song, In the Year 2525. I don't much care for this future shock genre. Life in the present is scary enough. But Children of Men has enough in common with James's great detective novels that I actually liked it more than I expected to. That may sound like a lukewarm recommendation, but I assure you, that's high praise coming from me. On my last visit to Disneyland, I sailed through Pirates of the Caribbean twice rather than set foot in Tomorrowland. The hero of this novel is named Theodore Farran. He's an Oxford historian and a more passive descendant of James's poet-detective, Adam Dalgleish. Farran confesses that he has a frugal heart, but when an ethereal woman named Julian approaches him and begs him to meet with her small band of humanitarian rebels, he's smitten. the rebels want Farron to use his influence with the warden, who just happens to be his cousin. They want to put an end to the brutal deportations the warden has instituted, as well as the mass euthanasia ceremonies called the Quietus. Farron agrees, but when he meets with his evil cousin, he unintentionally reveals the existence of the rebels. They're, of course, hunted down. Elongated chase scenes are mandatory in apocalyptic thrillers like this, and James gives us an especially creepy one. She also provides an on-the-road miracle. I don't want to give too much away. I'll just tell you it involves a manger. In the end, Children of Men is an unabashedly religious book. Mysticism has always been an aspect of James's mysteries. She's like G.K. Chesterton and Dorothy Sayers in her diagnosis of evil as a spiritual sickness. But here, the world has gone so wrong, no mere detective can set it right. I hear James's next novel will once again be a mystery. That's with a lowercase m. I'm relieved. Given the choice, I'd rather read about Colonel Mustard in the conservatory with a knife than rough beasts who trample over all the clues as they slouch toward Bethlehem, waiting to be born.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. She reviewed P.D. James's new novel, The Children of Men. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Audrey Voblaitis, Thad Kirk, and Richard Parker. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Journalist Robert Kaplan says that throughout the 80s, he tried with little success to interest editors and the general public in the Balkans and the brewing crisis there. On the next Fresh Air, we discuss his political travel book, Balkan Ghosts, which explains some of the history behind the current crisis. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.